Harry Constable in his own words. Episode 7. Work, War, and the Spike.
About 1934, I went on the docks as a casual man. I didn't have a registration book. When there was the work and when the employers wanted labour, I had to stand waiting to be called out. When work slackened, unregistered men were not required. The first day I stepped out in the cage at West India Dock was an experience that left a lifelong impression I never forgot. The call was 7:45 a.m. and I was there just after 7 o'clock and the packed crowd of men slowly built up. People were being crushed. As one man got out, two tried to take his place. It was bedlam. My first job on the docks was at the Colonial Wharf on Wapping High Street. My next job was discharging timber at the East India Dock. After a run of work, I got a job working aboard a boat discharging rice. I found it extremely hard. It was my first experience of handling bag work. The sacks of rice were very slack and extremely heavy. It was only one day's work and I needed the money. I also worked as a tea piler. That was a strong lad's job. We moved 180-pound chests of tea, piled five high.
Those who weren't employed on the docks permanently and didn't have a registration book were casual labour and would have to find something outside. When the docks were slack, everyone tried to find alternative work.
Outside the docks and wharves, I found work on extending the London Underground and I became quite proficient. I also did a job once in Canterbury Road, plucking chickens. After a while, I thought surely if I travelled, something would come my way. So I went on the road. There must have been a million people on the road at the time, driven to the same thing, all offering themselves to cut hedges or to do other jobs. I worked in sand and ballast pits for a few days. Then I got odd jobs out in the country on public works and labouring on building sites, or things like looking after a compressor. It was all education. I would seek work on tunnel construction, subterranean construction, and in engineering companies, and I learned about shaft sinking and driving headings. All this was great learning, and it came in handy when I joined the army later.
For the benefit of those who had never had the misfortune of being on the road before the war, or those who are not old enough to remember the workhouses which came into being with the beginning of capitalism, we had better explain that in Harry's childhood, every large town had a workhouse. Next to this institution was another building known as the Spike. The Spike housed people who were on the road looking for employment but did not have enough money to pay for a night's lodgings while travelling. The Spike opened at 6 in the evening and closed at 8. The interior was warm. Usually there was a very large hall, like a hospital ward, housing about 20 or 30 people. There was a limited amount of accommodation, so you had to be early. The chief thing about a Spike was that when you gained admittance, you were thoroughly supervised and cleaned. Your clothing was fumigated, and you were given a meal and refreshed generally. The bedding in the dormitory was cleaned regularly by the washing facilities that belonged to the council. You had to agree to stay for 3 days and nights if you'd not been in that Spike in the last couple of weeks or so. In the morning, everyone was up early, and those persons going on the road who had been there for 3 days and nights gathered together the bits and pieces that they owned. They were given sandwiches and a mug of tea before they left. If you were staying, work was allocated to you. A list of work available would be read out. Boilermen, gardener, laundry hand, and so on. Volunteers would be taken for the respective job. Nobody who was sick was supposed to have hard work beyond their ability. If you left within the 3 days and you were apprehended, you were handed over to the local magistrates who gave you a jail sentence of up to a month. That was for absconding after having agreed to accept work in return for board and lodging. There was a rule that you could not return to a particular Spike once you had left for the road, within a time limit of 2 weeks.
Some people might sneer at staying in such institutions, but believe me, the queues that started to form on bad evenings at those places I visited would move the heart of anyone. People tramped through the most appalling conditions to reach the spike. It was a saviour for many. In 1939, when the war broke out, I had been married a little more than a year. Because I had accumulated a good knowledge in subterranean works, I signed on as a sapper timberman. My thoughts at the time were that if I survived, there would be more opportunities for regular employment if I learnt another trade. After being put to work tunnelling and clearing up after the bombings, I was sent to Gibraltar. I then joined a squad boring and blasting out rock at a tremendous rate. Then, on the notice board, the following appeared. Volunteers wanted for a bomb disposal unit in London. I had already made up my mind that this was where I wanted to be. So I volunteered, got a warrant, and ended up at Balham in South London. I was sent to a nice house in Surbiton with the rest of the bomb squad. For the first time in quite a while, I felt at home. We were a happy-go-lucky bunch. I made an application for leave and got a few days. At the end of this break, I decided to extend it a little longer. I felt I was justified in doing this, and I was prepared to take the consequences. I returned about a week late, and the inevitable court-martial sent me to a prison camp for 28 days detention. A little over halfway through, the whole of the staff and prisoners were marched into a large hall where we were addressed by the regimental sergeant major.
He, the regimental sergeant major, told the men that a representative of the Russian embassy was to speak to them. There was, as usual, strict silence to be observed, but then there would be an opportunity to ask questions. The Russian ambassador's representative took the platform. Above all, he drove home the need for a second front. He said his country was bleeding to death. His people were dropping dead in the streets of Russian cities. The Russians did not have an inexhaustible population. Millions had been killed. Millions were freezing to death for the want of clothing. The hard-bitten men in the audience were visibly moved. The silence was stunning. Finally, the lecture was brought to a close and questions were asked for. There was a continued silence. They were prisoners under strict discipline, with the feeling they shouldn't risk putting forward the types of questions that were in everybody's mind. If they did that, who knew what the consequences would be after the guest had left? There was a further appeal for questions, but again, there were no volunteers. The chairman was about to close the meeting when Harry stood up in front of about 1,500 troops and staff.
The squaddies either side of me tried to pull me back to my seat. Then the chairman asked me to put my question. My point was the appalling manpower wastage in these camps, like the one we were in, while the Russians were being slaughtered. Most men were petty offenders. Almost all were tradesmen. Many had already seen long service overseas. There surely must be a better way to use manpower. There was no point being in camp, and I for one would rather be out for these 28 days digging up bombs. The shouting and cheering of the troops was only stopped when I said to the chairman, "I would appreciate if you could find the time to check on my release and give me the date when I will be set free." The silence came then, I think, because the other soldiers were wondering what was going to happen to me. Much to everybody's amazement, I was not put under guard, although the regimental sergeant major shouted at me, "What are you trying to do? Cause a bloody riot?" I never heard any more about the incident, and I was released on time, a very relieved man.
Harry had been in the army for 4 years when he was invalided out owing to the recurring effects of a blast he'd received in Gibraltar. Harry was looking forward to seeing his wife and baby son, but before he left for home, he received a telegram saying that his baby son had died.
I was shattered. It was not a very happy way back to Civvy Street.
If Harry don't go, then I don't go. If Harry don't go, then I don't go. If Harry don't go, then I don't go.
constable, in his own words, as told to Bill Hunter, was read by Christopher Eccleston and Ethna Brown.